Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and with me to discuss all the latest from the world of superyachts are our Deputy Editor Caroline White and Features Director Charlotte Hogarth-Jones. Charlotte, you conducted this week's interview. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I did. Well, I think we mentioned it on a podcast previously, but this is the call I did with Australian owner Jack Cowan. He's the owner of Hungry Jack's, which is basically like the Burger King of Australia. But he also has two rather beautiful boats. So we'll look forward to catching up with him later on in the podcast.
Brilliant. I look forward to hearing that. But first, let me tell you about what's happening on Friday night. Don't make any plans because it is the World Superyacht Awards virtual ceremony. The first ever virtual ceremony for the World Superyacht Awards, which of course are usually a very fancy gala in some fancy city somewhere in May. But due to COVID, we've had to go virtual. It's happening on Friday night, kicking off, I think, at 5 p.m. You can see all the nominees on our website. We had 57 entries this year, and there's some very, very special boats amongst them. And they were all whittled down into just a few winners by our panel of superyacht owning judges. Before we get to the headlines, I just wanted to dig into some global order book stats we've literally just received from our data guru, Raphael. So this is a big analysis of the industry we do in the January issue each year, and the raw data has just landed. And I thought I'd just, some of the headlines I thought I'd quickly go over in my very superficial analysis of those figures. And the big takeaway really is the industry has held up pretty well. So the global order book tracks the year of the global order book is from the end of August one year to the beginning of September the other. So the latest round of stats is from August the 31st, 2019 to September the 1st, 2020. And in that period, or rather as of the 1st of September this year, there were 819 superyachts in build or ordered with a deposit taken, which is actually up a little on last year, which is pretty amazing considering all that's happened. And when stacked end to end, those 819 superyachts would reach just over 33 kilometers. So not bad at all. Of those 119 yachts, 64 are explorers, which is the biggest number ever. So there are more explorers in build than any time in history.
That's rather interesting. I wonder if that could be because owners are looking for more solitude in their cruising, perhaps wanting to spend more time at sea rather than stopping in at lovely little restaurants and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's, well, we've heard this from a few people now. Yeah, absolutely. People do seem to be wanting to be a bit more autonomous and spending a bit more time away from land. I spoke to Espinoino recently for a piece I was doing, and he expressed the same thing. So people were telling him that the very big boats that he was designing with them, they wanted them to be much more autonomous so they could escape land for longer periods. So it's interesting, yeah, and it's certainly explorers feed into all that. Talking about massive boats, there are more 100-meter-plus boats in build than at any time ever. 23 100-meter-plus boats in build around the world. So there you go. So the appetite for massive boats and explorers hasn't been dulled at all, it seems. It's not all good news, however, as you'd expect. 20% is our estimate of this year's order book that has been delayed by COVID. So obviously, shipyards were closed for a period, so boats weren't being built at the same pace or the same rate as they were before. So some projects have been delayed. Well, 20% of those 819 projects have been affected by COVID in our estimation. Brokerage too has taken a bit of a hit over the period, with sales dropping to 356 from 408. Well, you know, it's not really surprising, is it, given everything that's going on, especially during the first lockdown in March, April and May, that really impacted sales and people's ability to see boats. So there you go. So if you want even more analysis, please look out for the January issue of Boat International, in which we'll go for a really big deep dive into all those figures and reveal a bit more about the state of the industry. Charlotte, tell us about Yachts for Science.
Yes, I will. It's come round again. So Yachts for Science is a program that Boat and a couple of other partners set up last year. And essentially the idea is we always had yacht owners coming to us and saying, I want to do something to do with ocean conservation. I want to do something helpful, but I don't know what to do. And this is just a really straightforward thing to do if you want to help this is how you can take a scientist on your boat. It's literally that straightforward. So last year we match made a number of different scientists and different yachts. The response from yacht owners was really encouraging and fantastic to see. So many people kind of offering berths on their boat, offering to kind of give scientists lifts out to areas of the ocean where they needed to be. And there was one really big trip that went ahead that you can read about on our site at the moment, which was with the scientist called Erica Gress, who studies black corals. She went on a yacht called Dunia Baru in Indonesia and was there for a couple of weeks doing research. So we're continuing that. So if you're watching the WSAs on Friday, you'll see a video message from one of the scientists involved. If you're following our Instagram, if you keep an eye out, the scientists will be kind of posting their projects on there. But essentially, if you're going to the Med or the Caribbean next year and you'd be happy to take someone on board with you, then please do. You can register your boat at yachtsforscience.com. You can ask us questions at yachtsforscience@boatinternationalmedia.com. It doesn't have to be an enormous commitment if you don't want it to be. It could be as simple as having a scientist come on board and attaching a bit of kit to your yacht. Or it could be something quite big. You could get them to come on board and train your crew to help with their investigations. A great thing to do, I think, if you've got family on board, if you've got your kids on board, how amazing to have a scientist sitting with you at dinner telling you about what they've discovered in the ocean around you. I mean, I think it's just a fantastic thing to do. And if you've got the space, you should definitely get involved.
So it's a matchmaking service fundamentally, isn't it? It's taking scientists who can't get to various far-off places with boats that do go to those places. So it's linking these two worlds of science and super yachts. So if you do have a berth going on your boat and you're going somewhere cool, why don't you fill it with a scientist and we can all advance the understanding of the oceans and conservation and even black corals and all sorts of cool stuff like that. And I think you can also trail buoys and things like that behind your boat, or trail various devices to measure temperatures and currents and all sorts of things. So it's an amazing initiative, actually, and it's been great to see it so well received.
In fact, if you go on our site at the moment, there's a big piece by Oliver Steeds, who's the CEO of Necton, this big deep ocean research institute, who've done very cool stuff with Blue Planet and going right to the depths of the ocean. And he's written quite a detailed article about the different things you can do to your boat if you want to get really seriously involved in terms of, you know, how much space you need to have a lab on board, how much space you need to have a winch to lift certain scientific equipment. But really, you know, you said it's matchmaking. We called it Tinder for the before, and that's essentially what it is. You tell us what you want to do and how seriously you want to get into it. We match you up with someone that we think is going to be on the same wavelength, and hopefully you both get something really fantastic out of the collaboration, and it's very flexible and easy to do.
Brilliant. And that's, so if you head to yachtsforscience.com, it's all there, or go to the homepage boatinternational.com and you can read Oliver's article all about how you can help. It's brilliant. Great. Thank you, Charlotte. Caroline, over to you with the news.
So first of all, we have some rather sad news that the former Perini Navi CEO Giancarlo Ragnetti has passed away. Ragnetti, who was 74, spent more than 20 years as chief executive of Perini Navi before stepping down in 2014, and he remained a board member. He began his career in commercial shipbuilding before joining Perini in the 70s, and his long list of achievements included redeveloping Perini Navi's brand and its core team, as well as increasing the yard's international reach and relaunching the Picciotti yard in 2007. Perini Navi chairman and chief executive Lamberto Taccoli has praised Ragnetti's humility and humanity and expressed his heartfelt condolences to his family and loved ones for the shared loss of a very special gentleman.
Yeah, there's been a bit of an outpouring from various members of a big chunk of the marine industry, actually, about Giancarlo's passing. He was a much loved character in the business, and obviously we extend our very best to his family and the whole Perini Navi family, actually, because they're all very close.
In launch news, Darman's first 77 Sea Explorer superyacht has been delivered. The bronze-hulled expedition yacht has left the Dutch yard and started a global charter itinerary, which is being managed by Edmiston. The yacht's Russian owner, Oleg Tinkov, has a small string of ultra-luxury holiday rental properties called La Dacha Tinkov Collection, and this yacht will be the jewel in that crown. The expedition yacht features two helicopters, a helideck and a heli hangar, a dive centre, two tender garages, and it can carry enough provisions for 40 days between ports. So it's a proper explorer yacht, and we look forward to hearing more about that boat. The 110-metre Ocean Cove Chaos, with a K, has been spotted on her maiden post-refit voyage off the coast of Gibraltar. Launched in 2017 as Jubilee by Ocean Cove, Chaos has been at Lursen for an extensive year-long refit. She was originally designed by Igor Lobanov, with interiors by Sam Sorgiovanni. Sorgiovanni has styled the alterations during the refit, both inside and out, but most work was done to the interior, which covered 1,500 square metres of space.
So I saw Jubilee not long after she'd been delivered. I had a really long tour, thanks to Burgess, early on, and there was a lot of stone on that boat. It was a Middle Eastern owner, and there was just this vast amount of stone, and it was incredibly detailed and beautifully put together, as you'd expect. So I can't wait to see, if we ever do get to see, the interior of the restyled Jubilee, now Chaos, because if they had to take out all that stone, it would have been a hell of a job. In fact, I think there was more stone on it than any other boat that had been done previously. I'd have to look back through my feature that I wrote a couple of years ago.
Wow.
But yeah, really ornate interior. So yeah, when a boat that idiosyncratic and that detailed and gets altered considerably by a new owner, it's always so interesting to see what they've done with it. So yeah, fingers crossed we get a view of that.
Speaking of very private boats that we've managed to have a look on board, we've had a first look on board the 85-metre Lursen Valerie, which was launched in 2011. She was known as Firebird, and she's been privately used and super secret ever since, with very little known about her other than her designers Espen Oino and Raymond Langton. Now that she's for sale with Dynamique, they've shared some images with us, which are on our website. She's known as a beauty, and she's particularly stunning at night when 39 underwater lights combine with her deck lighting to accentuate her curvaceous design. Pascal Raymond compares her interior to a jewellery box, and she drew inspiration in part from Claridge's Hotel in London and incorporated lots of Art Deco motifs, so she's a very glam boat inside. There's a lot more to say about this boat, including a really eye-popping piano, but you just have to look on our website and see for yourself.
Brill, thanks, Caroline. Yeah, I certainly encourage everyone to go and have a look at the Valerie. It's a really special boat and never before seen. You know, we've never featured the boat before in the magazine or anywhere. So definitely go and have a look at those pictures the first time she's been exposed, I suppose, anywhere. Right. Data. Let's talk data. Caroline, what do you got for us?
Well, with all the talk of the US election has got us thinking about the most distinctively American type of motorboat, the sports fisher. So we thought we'd take a peek into that very niche market. There are 252 24-metre plus sports fishers afloat with an average length of 27 metres, and 85% of them were built in the USA. The vast majority of the fleet is composed of series yachts, the most popular at the moment being the Viking 92 and the Viking 80. On which note, by far the most prolific shipyard is Viking, which has delivered 87 of the 24-metre plus sports fishers, nearly 35% of the total fleet.
They build a beautiful boat, Viking. And so what a lot of owners have, the massive super yacht, and they'll have the side yacht, I suppose. And that's so often a Viking. So you might, it's not uncommon to find a guy who's got an 80-metre, 100-metre boat. And then there's the Viking sports fisher that he keeps close to the home that he whips out on, does some fishing on. So yeah, they're very, very popular.
Yes, well, it's a niche that really seems to have boomed in recent years, with only two built in the 60s, five were built in the 70s, 14 in the 80s, and then you get to the 90s, 48 were built, 59 were built between 2000 and 2009, and 124 were built in the last decade. 2017 and 2018 were particularly successful years, with 24 and 22 delivered respectively. This year we've had slightly fewer, with 11, and next year about 10 are expected. Most owners are American, as I think I've mentioned, and most are repeat owners who've owned smaller sports fishers. The majority of the fleet is based in Florida or the Bahamas, where the fishing is good. Perhaps the most interesting upcoming project is Rybovich's future flagship, the 28.65 metre Three Amigos, which is scheduled for delivery next year. That has a really luxurious modern superyacht interior and some very cool touches like bar stools upholstered in Florida alligator hide and a dinette inspired by the cabin of a Ferrari. So lots of character there. Wow.
Yeah, plenty alligator hide, eh? Very nice. Right. That's it for this week. That's all the news and all the data and all the insight we could offer. So let's get to this week's interview. Charlotte, lead us in.
So if we're starting at the beginning, obviously I know that you grew up in Ontario. What was your kind of relationship like with the water and the lake? Did you spend a lot of time there, or was it just something that was always in the background?
I had no relationship with the water or the lake.
Really?
Where I lived was on the Great Lakes. We actually, as a kid, we had a house on the water, but it was kind of it was an expanse of water. We didn't, my family bought their first kind of boat, which is like a 20-foot little runabout, after I left to go away to university. So there was no boating. The water was not part of my life other than looking out the window at it. So that was as close as I got to it. So.
And do you think, did you then sort of get into boating via them by that second boat, that first boat that they'd bought, or did you kind of arrive at it independently?
No, that was after the fact. I had left the nest by then, and I was out, as I say, I'd gone away to university, and I just, that's as close as we ever got to being close to a yacht. It was a small kind of runabout, little cabin cruiser, which they used to, we lived on a river, and my father, that was probably his kind of extension of his childhood rather than anything else. And but I was not really part of that. And I'll jump around here a bit. Sure. And your job is to keep this on track. First of all, at the age of 26, I left Canada, moved to Australia to start up a business, and which I did. Lived in Perth for 10 years, which is on the west coast of Australia. Moved to Sydney, and I became friends with a man by the name of Dennis O'Neill, who is a famous Olympic sailor. He sailed in the Olympics, and he was famous in Sydney for having built boats of all different shapes and sizes. And he fit the mold that you described later in your questions as someone who likes the process rather than the end result. And as soon as the end result arrives, you sell it. And that was him. Mm. Anyway, in the late 90s, he came to me with a business proposition that the Australian dollar at that stage of the game had fallen to a record low of 49 cents. And he came with the business proposition that you could build a boat in Australia with 49 cent dollars and we'll take it to Europe and sell it in either US dollars or euros. And on the currency exchange, we'd make a fortune. So that was the proposition, and so it was a business transaction, an investment transaction, rather than kind of a great deep desire to have any kind of a boat of my own. I had in
but
the
really, it was a purely a business move from your point of view.
Yeah, but there were a lot of fallacies attached to that. The first thing we found out was that a lot of the materials came from the U.S., the engines, Caterpillar, and, so what seemed to be an interesting investment proposal, which was based on building in one currency, selling in another, evaporated as the costs went on, kept going up, anyway, yeah. Do you find it
hard to limit the costs? Because, I mean, you'd think someone with...
I didn't have anything to do with it. He was the expert. I'm just supplying, you know, half the money to do this. And so I didn't have anything to do with it. He was the boat expert. And right. I'm just the financier. So 3 years later, the boat's finished, and we put it on a freighter and sent it to Europe. And it was there for about a week, and we had an offer from someone to buy it. And, a relatively attractive offer. We weren't going to get rich because it cost a lot more than what we thought. Mm. But he wanted to sell it. And because, as I say, he was interested in the process, and he'd made, 99.9 all the decisions. So I said, look, Dennis, we spent 3 years building this, and I had kind of this fantasy of spending some time floating around the Mediterranean. At least we can get a year or two. And I said, no, I want to accept this. This is a decent offer. Let's accept that.
Yeah.
So I had no choice either to buy him out or accept the offer. So I decided to buy him out. So I now own a boat. And with no kind of experience, no kind of, none of the kind of the nautical culture that kind of grows with the industry of people that have grown up with it.
And can you pinpoint what about it made you not want to let go? Was it literally just because you hadn't stepped
forward? Well, it was the fantasy.
Or was there a kind of growing interest
in
there?
In the mid-80s. You probably weren't born at this stage, but the America's Cup was a big thing in Australia in 1983, won the America's Cup, and Alan Bond, who I knew, he had what I thought was a magnificent boat at that stage of the game, and we're one of his sponsors in the America's Cup. So we got invited, and we spent a week kind of in the south of France on his boat, and that was a whole new experience for me and a whole new... And I loved it. I thought it was fantastic, the experience. And so I had that kind of memory from the mid-80s through until, there we are 15 years later. I now own a boat sitting in Europe, don't know what to do about this. So the good news was we hired a captain who happened to be kind of 2IC on Kerry Packer's boat, which... Right. Happened to be in Sydney at the time, and we actually hired him in Sydney, and he went to back to his name's Phil Stevens. Anyway, he's still with me, 20-odd years later. He's still the captain of the new boat.
First boat then, that wasn't built to your kind of specifications and your wants and your needs, because it was built purely for the market. So how did you change, having spent time on that? So that was Silver Dream, presumably?
Yes.
Then how did you, when you came to Slipstream, how did you change it? You said, okay, I've had a boat.
Well, here's what I want. That boat was launched in 2001, Silver Dream. Mm-hmm. And, I now spend the next boat was launched in 2009, Slipstream, and that probably took best part of 3 years as well. So I had 5 years from 2001 of sailing around. We took it to the Maldives every year, in the winter. We went to the Caribbean. We went to Thailand, and we were really adventuresome in kind of using it. And so I fell in love with the idea of, isn't this a terrific way to see the world and do things, invite friends. We chartered it out, living in Australia. It wasn't like we were there using it full time. So when it was available, we chartered it out. And that, so anyway, I really liked the idea. So we got actively involved in the building of the new one, and that was a very different experience.
Yeah.
But by now, I'd had 5 years of romance of the love of having a nice boat.
So what was on your hit list then? What did you say? Okay, this time it's mine. Here's what I want.
It's 60 meter boat. It was built in France. One of your questions is how was that as an experience? And I had going into that, again, not knowing much about how to build a boat, I had all kinds of trepidation about, you know, different languages. You know, you hear the horror stories about, you know, people getting into huge, big fights over, you know, the costs and the overruns and the changes and things like this. And it was built by a French company called CMN. And they were new to the yacht business, and they had built prior to that largely military vessels. And
did it feel like a bit of a risk going with a build that were kind of...
Well, yeah, I was very nervous. I was nervous, particularly when they said, oh, French, you're not going to understand. You're not going to be able to communicate. But I can tell you, we did not have any issues that were not able to be resolved, and it was a very pleasant experience. And I know that's very different than what a lot of other people may have been down. But it was amazing. As I said, I went in with all kinds of trepidation. The other thing that happened is a good friend of mine by the name of Brett Blundy, we designed our boat, did our thing. And he also wanted to get a boat. So we built two of these at the same time, twin boats. This was called Cloud Nine, which he's later sold and kind of moved on. But so this French company, CMN, had at that stage of the game, you know, two, you know, it's kind of early in the piece. They built several yachts before this, but these were the biggest boats they built before. And anyway, it was almost without, any real trouble that was not able to be resolved very quickly. So to my surprise...
How hands-on were you with the process?
How what?
How sort of hands-on were you? Were you involved in every aspect of the design?
No, I mean, we hired, you know... Burgess were our agents, and they're in the business of, they provide engineers and people that know what they're doing, and, you know, they kind of ran that side of it, and they were the first line of defense in trying to negotiating on anything that had to be changed. My wife and I, we got involved in kind of the, you know, so anything from a mechanical point of view, which I knew nothing about, that was separate, and we got involved in the interior design of the boat, of the colors and the fabrics and things like that.
And what sort of taste would you say you had? What's the kind of look of it?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we did a couple of crazy things. One, I think we probably have the only boat in the world that has a totem pole in it. You know, and this is kind of part of, we went back and said, okay, this is our Canadian heritage. And so we had built from kind of the one deck up to the first level. There's this I don't know how tall it is, 15 foot totem pole, which we had built in British Columbia, sent to, and it is very distinctive, and I've never seen another one. I may never see another one again.
Was it difficult to install that and ship it and everything?
No, quite not really. No. I mean, my wife went to visit this Indian, North American Indian, who was quite a famous totem pole maker. As a matter of fact, there's a totem pole at Buckingham Palace. You'd be pleased to know that this same man was a designer for him. So, you know, he built it, and they built it with kind of a story that goes, I don't know if you've ever seen a totem pole, but there's stories with, you know, the eagle eating the fish, boom, boom. So anyway, that, and then we had, you know, a number of kind of, you know, grizzly bear kind of artifacts and things like this. And the art which we chose was largely Aboriginal art from Australia. So it was kind of a little touch of our heritage of being Canadians by birth and growing up there, and that we had kind of some sense of that. And then the artwork of Australian was kind of the Australian kind of later part of our lives.
Would you say it's a similar aesthetic to your home, or does it feel like a bit of a departure and it's a completely different kind of space?
Yeah, it's different. It's different. Yeah, that's what this was fun, and it was an adventure more than kind of, you know, practicality, you know. And as I say, how practical is a totem pole in a boat? Not too much. So yeah. But anyway, no. But it all came together well. And, you know, every time we go on the boat, we're quite proud of it. It's, you know, it is now 10 years old. And so it's in the process of a boat to head to the Maldives.
Right.
We have a charter. We have a 6-week charter with a Russian family. And then depending on whether or not COVID restrictions and all that get lifted, we'll try and go there. You know, we're hoping that you know, Australia's really been kind of, we're in prison here. Mm-hmm. And so,
and could
again,
you
you're headed that way again.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very depressing at this end, I have to say. But one of the things I wanted to ask you was, I know that some owners have been kind of essentially forming their own little bubble on board. Like, I was reading Jonathan Rothberg, the owner of Gene Machine, who's trying to develop a test for one. And him and his family, essentially, at the first sign of COVID, holed up on the yacht. Anyone coming on board had to display a positive, negative COVID test before they could come on, and they're kind of waiting it out, if you want, on board. Can you see yourself doing something like that, or not really?
Well, we're hopeful that you know, we're on the downside that some of these restrictions are going to go away. But we had a charter in August with an English family for 3 weeks in the Mediterranean. And one of the conditions of the charter was that the crew and captain had to be in isolation on the boat with no external before the family came on. Mm. And that was, you know, they didn't want to get on the boat and then find some crew member had COVID-19. And so anyway, that was the deal. So, and they, you know, we were compensated for that. I'm hopeful that the coronavirus and all that, but you know, but who knows? You know, if we can get the Maldives are, you know, apparently are, as we sit here today, are relatively okay.
Yeah.
And
how has this period been for you business wise? Has it been quite stressful, or do you quite enjoy the challenge of something new?
Yeah, no. Our business, we have been very fortunate in that the, you know, the food service businesses that we are in, the two things that have really boomed in during the last 8 months have been home delivery of food, and secondly, the drive-through aspects, you know, where you put your hand out the window and in the car. And the reason why they have been so strong is the fact that it's minimal contact. You know, you're not standing next to someone in line who coughs and things like this. So, so our business has been really strong. So, but it's more good luck than good management. If we'd been in New Zealand where they closed everything, you know, forget about home delivery. They shut everything down. But we've been able to continue to stay in business with, as I say, the home delivery and the drive-through. It's been really tough and difficult for people that, you know, your standard restaurant where they limit the number of people that can go in the restaurant, even if they can open. In Melbourne today, you know, they can't open the restaurants. So we've been lucky.
And I wanted to ask, actually, in terms of sort of non-COVID related things, I was really interested to read that you're investing in this food company that's looking at kind of meat alternatives. That's something that was kind of in the press a lot. So do you think that's the future? When do you think we're going to stop eating meat? Or do you think those two things are going to both be equally popular in 10 years' time? What's the kind of forecast, I guess?
Our view is that the meat industry is not going to go away, but the cow is a very inefficient producer of protein, and you know, the amount of space, the amount of water, the amount of feed, to produce, a kilo of beef in a cow versus growing plants that have protein that can be extracted and made into meat, meat-like products, that one, this will be a lower cost way of being able to feed people, and it's more efficient than what, as I say, the cow is. The cow, any kind of millennial have anything that is planet friendly, they love. And yeah. So the cow, if you look at it, you know, the methane gas that kind of comes out their rear end, that is a big kind of contributor to the global warming argument. The extremely high level of that is a problem. Antibiotics, farm people feed cattle all kinds of antibiotics, and then that gets you, eat the meat, the antibiotic kind of comes in your system. You want to take an antibiotic because you got some bug, and they then, it doesn't affect because you already got the abattoirs. I don't know if you've ever been to an abattoir, so there are lots of the cattle industry per se is not without its problems. So if you can have a way of making product, first rule number one is it's got to taste good. If it doesn't taste good, you're wasting your time. So yeah. And I can in our businesses, they have a kind of, they love telling the story that they had a taste test with me, and they had based on a real meat, and they said, guess which is which, and I, quite playing a straight bat, got it wrong. And so, as I say, the products that are being developed today are very difficult to tell, and they taste good. And they're being made into mints or being made into patties. And the issue, the major factor is that, there's 7 billion people on the planet today. By the time we get to 2050, we're supposed to have 10 billion, and the existing agricultural system can't operate and feed, 50% more people. We just don't have the space to be able to do it. So we have to be able to find a more productive way to do it. And as I say, if the costs go up, if we can find a lower cost way, then there are lots of people around the world in Africa and these other places that don't get enough protein. So bring the cost down. You can improve the diet of the 10 billion people. But most importantly, we can produce more food in a much more efficient manner to feed 50% population growth. So that's kind of some of the driving factors here. So we've just raised, we're in the process, we just finished the second fundraising. We just raised, and we raised $35 million in the Series A. Series B, we're just completing another 70-odd million. So based on a value of, something like $350 million market value for this business. So there are two companies in the U.S., one called Impossible and Beyond, which have values which are kind of eye-watering, $7-8 billion. So we're kind of in the beginner stake, but we think we've got products that are quite competitive, and so we think there's a big future, and the initial results are that this is a strong growth area that we're backing and hope that it'll continue.
Well, best of luck with that. It sounds sounds promising. Yeah. You clearly have this, incredible passion for business, and you got into yachting, sort of approaching it from a business angle. Is there anything you do that is purely for fun and it has no business connection at all, or is that always the kind of route into things for you?
Well, living in Australia, to go to Europe, it's a fair hike, and you don't do this like every weekend.
Yeah.
So we've been doing this now for 20 years, and in doing that, you know, I have carried this guilt that you don't want to do this on your own. So you end up inviting friends and things like this. And I think there's a very rare, I think my wife and I have been on the boat on our own, like for two nights in 20 years, whenever we've been there, because you invite people to share it with you. And so, you know, we have tried to use this as a form of entertaining our friends and family, you know, that we got four kids, 12 grandkids. Because of the cost of being able to go to Europe and back, they can't use it like if it was sitting in Sydney Harbor. Yeah. So the original boat, Silver Dream, is on the process of on its way back to Australia. So we've decided, and I think the lockdown of having the boat sitting in Europe and not being able to use it, which we can't because we can't leave the country. You have to get government permission to leave, which sounds strange, Australia. Yeah. And then if you want to come back, you got to go into a hotel in isolation for two. So anyway, everybody here has been kind of confined to, you know, staying at home. And so we got these two boats sitting in Europe. So we've decided to bring Silver Dream back to Australia. Yeah. And it is a boat to leave for the Maldives as well. And then it'll go to Thailand, and then probably we'll find a way to come back through Northern Australia and, you know, Papua New Guinea. There's some very exotic places along that northern coast of Australia, Indonesia.
And are you looking forward to getting back on board?
Yes, very much so.
It must be frustrating to feel kind of stuck and you want your boat, but it's miles away.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so we're in the process, as I say, we've made that decision and that's in motion. And this time next year, the boats will be in Sydney Harbour and we will be able to probably have a more conventional use. The charter business doesn't exist in Australia to the same extent that it does in Europe, where you've got your Russians and Middle East and Americans and European, you know, everybody kind of, you know, focuses on that. So the charter, but we will be able, you know, the business, the charter business, I think will grow in Australia with time, you know.
What do you think is the key to that? What do you think needs to happen for it to really take off over there?
Well, first of all, we got to get back to normality. Okay, we have to get away from all this kind of problems that we've, you know, the hotel business, everything in Australia is just ground to a halt. You know, there is no internet. We're much more restricted than what you are living in the UK. So that has to eventually right itself and, you know, come back to a normal. But the future, one of the futures of Australia is tourism. And, you know, last year there were 100 million Chinese had passports to travel internationally. And this is before the corona. And 1 million came to Australia. So what we are seeing in this part of the world is over the last 10, 20 years, the living standards in Asia are continuing to increase. Mm. And as living standards and disposable incomes increase, they will want to gravitate to things that you and I like doing, i.e. going on nice boats.
Okay, and any new boats on the horizon?
We're thinking about it. We had a close call in the last 12 months. A year ago, the September boat show, we were in kind of the final stages of negotiating, and then as we progressed closer and closer to getting contract to start, the coronavirus came in, late in the year. So the good news is that we just kind of put that on hold, so that's where it sits today.
That's it for this week's Boat Briefing. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Have a great week.